Well, bees, poo and parasites are the pet topics of our next guest, the comedian and science communicator Alanta Colley. With a background in international public health and a passionate bee advocate, her comedy is always cram-packed with fun facts and cool science. Her first solo funny science show, Parasites Lost, sold out its entire run at Melbourne International Comedy Festival in 2017. Her second solo show, Days of Our Hives, attracted more beekeepers than any other show at the Comedy Festival. And she's recently been prepping for a new show, Origin of the Feces, with apologies to any number of esteemed authors and scientists and some pretty terrible soap writers as well. We welcome our guest Alanta Colley from Melbourne. How are you?
I'm good, thanks, Catherine. Thank you for having me.
I can't help thinking, and the listeners will be too, it's a bit awkward to be a scientist making fun of parasites at the moment, isn't it? We're all a bit angry, frankly, with what one little natural virus is wreaking upon our human worlds. I think it's too soon for some jokes about this one, do you think?
Yes, yeah. I think, there's always the question of what's too soon, but a lot of my poo research was looking at allergies and how our gut microbiomes have actually grown less diverse due to the enormous amount of hygiene that we've been doing in the last 100 years. But yes, it doesn't seem quite the right time to talk about how wonderful bacteria is, even though it is pretty great.
Well, yeah, we'll do that another time. It's more like an evil genius story at the moment, isn't it? A sort of a dystopian evil enemy that's found all our weak points. But anyway, the havoc is unprecedented in modern times anyway. Are scientists funnier than we expect? Do we often see them, you know, presenting factual material in a serious way? Are most of them actually hilariously funny? What's your experience?
I think so. I think there's opportunity for comedy in every walk of life. And I think we associate scientists with being very humorless and having to remove research because objectivity is so important. And scientists are trained to present the data without their personality getting in the way and subjectivity. But my main attraction to it is talking about looking for comedy in something that people don't always look for comedy in. So, yeah, it's ripe for opportunity. I mean, we saw an astrophysicist just yesterday admitted to hospital because he has two magnets stuck up his nose. He was in isolation. And
that's supposed to stop when you have three, isn't it?
Yeah, I think he was getting a bit bored in isolation and was trying to create a magnet bracelet that would tell you when you were about to touch your face. And things escalated from there. So he tried to clip it onto his ear to see if it would work that way. And then his nose, and then all four magnets sort of made their way north up his nasal cavity. So I think plenty of people having a good time with that story this morning.
It's interesting, isn't it? What do you do with a scientist or a scientific researcher in lockdown? Yeah, those busy, busy minds. your background was in public health. Tell me a little bit more about it, Alanta.
Yeah, so I studied public health many years ago. I found myself in Cambodia volunteering with the United Nations Fund for Women, and I was sort of looking around at all the different ways that people can work in different countries, and public health sort of came to the fore, and seeing that, you know, clean drinking water, vaccinations are really the sort of groundswell that now allow any community to sort of achieve whatever they want to achieve. So I came home and studied public health, and that took me off. I spent 2 years in Uganda working on HIV prevention and malaria prevention programs. I only contracted malaria twice while I was over there, so it was a success, really. So I've worked in a few different countries in Southeast Asia with communities on health education about how to prevent various diseases and parasites. And it's definitely a passion of mine.
So your job was to teach others about how to avoid diseases. How many did you experience? Malaria, very nasty. Were there any other experiences that you have reflected on with more humour as time has passed than at the time?
Time plus tragedy equals comedy. Yeah, I think I've contracted six parasites at last count. over time. So yes, great failure there, educating others how to prevent diseases and contracting them myself. It's more of a sort of method acting approach to public health. Yeah, my probably least favorite, I mean, there's many to pick from, but one was a little sand flea in Uganda. They're called a jigger. And if you get about in Uganda with no shoes on, these little sand fleas latch onto your foot and then they dig themselves into your skin, and then the female swells up and lays all of her eggs and then promptly dies, which is just rude, really. But what before she dies, she actually, you become a mobile vending machine, and she actually just kicks her eggs out of the hole in your skin as you walk around. So you're sort of just disseminating her eggs across the landscape for her. It's a weird partnership.
You're like a little seed spreader, aren't you? Or like your wonderful bees. You're kind of like a, what I'm just going to say, fertilizer. That's not right.
Pollinator.
Yeah. Much nicer job in life. They are ingenious, aren't they? There was one particularly nasty parasite. One of our science educators here, Susie Wiles, a regular science commentator at RNZ, has a tremendous sense of humour too, and she's in charge of a bioluminescence lab. She's had to neglect it for a while, actually. The little shiny coloured greeblies will be missing their beloved. But she was describing to us once about this particularly nasty parasite that sort of got into your brain and ate it from the inside out. So you didn't realise it was happening until it was too late. They are like kind of evil, brilliantly evil, I was going to say inventions, but processes of evolution, I suppose. If this works, I'll do it.
Absolutely. And I think we think of them as weird and wonderful, but we are ourselves co-evolved with various viruses and bacteria. I mean, we know now there's more bacterial cells in a human body than human cells. So we are sort of part of this landscape of parasites and, you know, all these interconnected relationships with microorganisms that we actually need to survive. So, yeah, it's a... I think we've spent the 20th century sort of figuring out a lot of the names of these bacterias and pathogens and killing them. And now I think we're just starting to hit that point in science where we're like, oh, I think we needed some of those.
This is particularly with respect to the gut. And I want to talk about that a little bit more in a moment. But first, that nasty little parasite you had, was this the one that got into your intestine or somehow? Or is that just one of many that got into your intestine somehow on your travels?
Look, it's been an Airbnb for microorganisms in there. they don't even leave a tip. The jigger was just an external one, but I've had Giardia, and I've also had Blastocystis hominis, which is another amoebic parasite. The one that I didn't contract, but I learned all about, I think it's probably my favourite parasite, if you can say that, is the guinea worm, which is still kicking around in parts of sub-Saharan Africa. And it's this worm that grows up to a metre long in the intestine. And then when it's ready to reproduce, the female actually burrows a hole the whole way down your leg, and she creates this little sore near your ankle. And when you step into, and she releases chemicals that make it feel like your leg's on fire. And so you go and immerse yourself in fresh water, and then she actually releases eggs through the hole into the water supply and sort of creating this beautiful circle of life. As you say, it is it's horrifying and also ingenious how these things actually evolved to get to that.
It is, because they don't have brains, I presume, most of them. It's not like they've sat down and plotted this out and they thought, right, there's a biped that's going to go swimming if I make its legs hot.
That's it. All evolution is an accident. It's just the one that happened to do it that way, reproduced and survived. Each mutation was a pure accident. So, yeah, it's pretty amazing.
How old are many of them?
That's a really good question. Parasite, it's a funny thing because it's not actually a genus. It's not a specific sort of creature. So we see parasites in worms. We see parasites in amoebas, a single cell organism. So they're sort of all across the spectrum. I mean, leeches are also parasites. But we are just seeing what's really interesting at the moment is we're seeing with global warming and the permafrost in various parts of the world actually melting. We're seeing various parasites and other sorts of organisms actually emerging that have been frozen for many, many years. And a lot of scientists have actually been predicting that one of the next global public health challenges will be the return of various parasites that we have not seen within our lifetimes or the last 100 to, you know, several hundred years.
Yeah, another reason to perhaps try and do something about climate change at some point. Who knows? One of the outcomes of the hideous drama that the globe's dealing with at the moment is it might move some things along that have proved rather hard to advance. And I suppose that's one of the things we try and hold on to, is if this is going to happen to us, what's the good change we can have come out of it, as well as everything else we're dealing with? Let's talk a little bit about the comedy, because it was the parasites that got you going at the, well, got you the big, you know, the big name in lights run at the Melbourne International Comedy Fest. And what do you do with something like Parasites Lost on stage? Is it just stand up and just running us through a lot of amazing facts with humour attached? Like, how did you develop the show?
A friend actually suggested the title to me, and as soon as he said the words Parasite Lost, I knew exactly what show I would write. And as you mentioned at the start, I'm a science communicator and comedian. So basically, I present it in chronological order, each of the parasites, that and I sort of did the sort of history of the parasite, how it the main transmission routes, and then I told the story about how I contracted each one. And then basically, it's basically the whole show is a advertisement of how bad I am at public health, at my own job. It's not a very strategic strategy for getting work in public health.
The second solo show, Days of Our Hives, same comedy festival, I think, and this is another strand of another one of your great loves. Are you seriously into your beekeeping?
I love beekeeping. Yeah. Again, in my 20s, was just sort of bumming around Europe, and I found a lot of your listeners will probably have heard of woofing, which is willing workers on organic farms, which is this great opportunity that you can actually volunteer to work on an organic farm in exchange for food and board, which is delightfully medieval. And I found myself in the Czech Republic on an apiary with these amazing Czech scientists who were researching the varroa mite and how that actually impacts bees. And they had a particular kind of bee, which is these Russian bees, and Russian bees are known for being very aggressive. And I learned so much about bees. I had to confront my fear, and I learned very quickly that fear, particularly around bees, is about ignorance. You can actually learn so much about bees. The sound that they're making is different. You can tell if they're just happy or excited that you're melting down some wax, and you can tell if they're angry and they just really want you to move away from their hive. So they're actually very communicative little insects, and I fell in love with them, and could not wait to get back to Australia and start my own urban beekeeping, which is what I've done.
You like to learn in an experiential way.
That's a very polite way.
And did you learn what the angry noise sounded like the hard way as well?
I sure did. Beekeeping is you learn by trial and error, sometimes more error than than others. And bees let you know if they're not very happy with you. And there's been a few times when I've been in my backyard doing some urban beekeeping and really annoyed the bees. And in my white beekeeping suit, I've had to just go for a walk around the block to lose some of the more of the angry bees. And I think half of my neighbours have figured out that I'm a beekeeper. I think the other half just think I have a hobby nuclear reactor in the backyard. And I'm just not sure which ones of them are more worried.
By which possibility? Did you have to get in the car once to get away? Because seriously, if they have decided they're going for you, can they be that determined?
Yeah, there's if you really push hard with certain bees, particularly Russian bees who are very angry, they go into what they call kamikaze mode. And I haven't seen it much with my own bees, my Italian bees. But yes, once in the Czech Republic, a bunch of the bees went into kamikaze mode, had to get in the car with the beekeeper and drive 5 kilometers away, and the bees were still following the car and in the cabin, and we had to get out and just very sadly, there's probably a handful of bees by this point, just deal with each bee one-on-one. But that's pretty rare. That's really, you only see that with the more aggressive types, and most hobby beekeepers go with the more gentle kinds of bees.
How did they know you were in the car?
They've got extremely good vision. They're good with motion. I just love how incredibly clever bees are. So they can travel up to six. They travel in a day up to 6 kilometres away from the hive, and they navigate their way back. So yes, one should not underestimate a bee and its capacity.
Don't they dance? Don't they do a dancey thing to tell the others where to come and make a hive or come? What's the story with dancing?
Yeah, I think we're just the very start of understanding how bees actually communicate to each other. So there's the most famous bee communication technique is the waggle dance. And this is when a bee tells all of the other bees that it's found some really excellent flowers, and it goes to an area in the hive, which is called the dance floor. I'm not joking there. A lot of the cool stuff about bees has already been named by very funny beekeepers before my time. But they go to the area in the dance floor and they dance in this figure of eight across the comb. And the more energetically they dance, they're actually communicating how much food, how much nectar and pollen they've found. So they communicate that way. And the angle at which they dance across the comb indicates the direction of where the flowers are in relation to the angle to the sun. And they're incredibly accurate, and they never get lost. So they're extremely good communicators, very good at giving directions to each other. And one of my favorite facts is they communicate to each other the distance, how far away the flowers are, by how energetically they dance. And the best thing is they're not communicating in kilometers per se. They're communicating in how much bee energy it takes to reach the flower. And so if it's a windy day, they'll actually dance for longer to indicate that it's going to take more energy to fly into the wind to reach these particular flowers. That's pretty great.
They're like cyclists or something, isn't it? Interesting they have eyesight. I always think of the fly. I'm still traumatised by the movie, the original, of course. It's just one of those things that's forever sort of seared into memory. Help me. But is their eyesight, like the fly's eyesight's really weird, isn't it? I think they call it the compound eye, doesn't it? It doesn't look like human vision. Is the bee able to focus? I don't think a fly can focus. Can a bee focus?
I think they can. I'm not going to say too many things that I'm just guessing, but I do know that they've got quite good colour vision. So they can see a vast array of blues and greens and purples they've discovered. So the big thing in science, in biology at the moment is running various tests with bees to see what colours they can see and how they respond. And we're learning that bees have some sort of emotion as well. And bees can get very happy when they're rewarded, and they can get sad when those rewards are taken away. So it's funny because I think we've always known, if you sort of read the ancient sort of medieval scripts, there's always been a sense that bees know more than we think they do. And they've always been sort of celebrated in mythology. The ancient Aegeans believed that bees actually transported you on the journey to the other side, to the next life. And I think we're now just sort of starting to understand some of the complexities of just how smart and social bees are.
Well, their eyesight's good enough to chase an orange Datsun full of beekeepers thereafter anyway. We know that much, don't we? Alanta Colley is our guest, comedian and a science educator as well, with a background in international health. You are listening to 9 to Noon on RNZ National. Right, I politely left the poo till last because it's public radio. But look, there's always humour, isn't there? Whenever there's bodily functions, there's humour, right? The latest one, Origin of the Feces, you're prepping this right now. What's the science you're delving into?
I think it actually started. I started getting interested in this when I was doing Parasites Lost, and just learning about some of the incredible research that's being done at the moment with fecal transplants. So the research behind it is it's social and it's scientific. I'm really interested in how fecal transplants work. What happens when a donor gives a small sample of their own poo to somebody else, and all of the different ways that that's being used. I mean, they're now using fecal transplants to treat some of the more severe challenges with autism. They're treating diabetes. They're treating depression as well with fecal transplants. So it's a really interesting space. And I'm also interested in just how we as a species became so terrified of poo. There's this sort of research to show that kids under the age of 2 have no disgust response to feces at all. So it's culturally learned. So we sort of
passed this on. Did that take research?
I think it started as anecdotal and then make it statistically significant.
So it's a learnt shame is what you were trying to say.
Exactly. Mm. And I delved into the ancient scriptures. I had a look at the Dead Sea Scrolls. I had a look at the Bible and the Torah. And every ancient text has some instruction to their followers to not be covered in shit, to not be covered in feces. And so that's sort of, this is definitely society has decided that they're not very fond on it, and that everyone should have a good wash regularly.
Is it cultural with respect to taboo, or is it more as adults we begin to suspect there might be hygiene issues around it? I mean, I don't want to go near smell, but it's too late now. But that's often, it's like food rotting, isn't it? It's the human takes that as a signal that something might be off. Is there a logic to the way we prefer not to roll around in it the way the dog does? In science and in health?
Absolutely. I think we often look at tradition as a set of just archaic practices. But the fact is, most traditions actually came from very practical reasons. And I think many cultures have figured out that there's some link between feces being in the streets and infection and the spread of disease. And lots of cultures have built hygiene practices into their traditions. For example, in Islam, you cannot read or recite the Torah unless you've completely washed. The Quran. It's one of those things that I think what we perceive as tradition is actually a set of practical guidelines that have been built into culture over time.
Fecal levels in water, for example, is one of the things that we measure in order not to get sick. And do we loop all the way back now to the parasites and bacteria? Are they often making a home in a place that we tend to not think about, talk about, or want to look at as well?
Exactly. There's quite a lot of when we defecate, there's actually quite a lot of live bacteria and other pathogens in our feces. I think up to 30% of the dry weight of our feces is actually alive and dead bacteria. So when we go to the toilet, what we produce isn't completely dead. It's it's actually got a lot of living things in it. So it makes sense that over time we've decided to keep that away from our living area and our drinking water. And that seems to have worked out for humanity fairly well to date.
There's some interesting facts in here about dogs, again, who do have a different attitude than the rest of us, that's for sure. But there's some, I can't believe I'm saying this, but it's in your show, so I'm allowed to. Is it true that dogs defecate on a north-south axis? Like, are they that organised?
Yeah, this is fascinating. I when I found this story, I was like, oh, I have to talk about this. And what I love more than anything is just, I just want to know how these scientists gained the funding to run this research of following 75 different breeds of dog over a course of 2 months. And every time the dog urinated or defecated, they had to get the compass out and actually check which direction the dog was facing. But their research was conclusive. It turns out that when dogs go to the toilet, they tend to align themselves on the magnetic north-south axis. Way more often than they don't. And some other people have done some research to show that often when the dog doesn't align itself with the north-south axis, there's actually evidence that there's a magnetic flare in the Earth's magnetic, radius? No. So this is really interesting research. I don't know why, and the scientists haven't quite nailed exactly why this is. But what it does suggest is that something in the brain of a dog does read the magnetic field of the Earth, very much like birds. We know that birds navigate using the magnetic field of the Earth as well. So there's something sort of linking dogs and birds and all other animals back to some common ancestor that has this capacity in their brain.
You know that research began with someone sitting on the couch watching Bruno or observing Bruno out the window and going, "What?" And away it went from there. Wonderful stuff, Alanta.
Exactly.
Lovely to talk to you. And all the best to you and yours. Oh, actually, one thing I was going to ask you about, that you're in the arts community, and of course, honestly, the comedians are keeping us sane at the moment. There's so many online comedians. I shouldn't name them, but, you know, there's one or two in particular at the moment. I'm almost daily going in for whatever they have uploaded. In fact, there's a real outpouring of sharing of humour, COVID-themed humour, at the moment to help relieve the stress. But of course, the whole infrastructure and sort of payment structure for artists has taken such a whack at the moment.
Yeah, it really has. I feel like the arts community, the performing community, were the first to be hit in a lot of ways because the very first wave, particularly in Australia and I imagine in New Zealand as well, of implementations was to stop gatherings of 50 to 100 and outdoor gatherings of 500. And that shut down an entire industry overnight. The Melbourne Comedy Festival had to cancel a week before it kicks off, and Melbourne Comedy Festival is the third largest comedy festival in the world. So there's over 600 shows that got cancelled at very short notice. And it is a challenge. So there's a lot of talk in Australia of supporting sole traders who've sort of been left out of work very quickly. But comedians don't tend to register on that sort of economic, well, yeah, as sole traders. So there's a lot of discussion about ways that we can actually support artists. And as you mentioned, a lot of artists who are now stuck at home are getting very creative with live broadcasts. I've seen burlesque in people's bedrooms going on, which is fantastic. But there's also so much for comedians to now provide commentary on. The sort of experience of people suddenly being isolated and having to deal with their own thoughts is producing a lot of rich fodder for comedy, I think.
It is, and they're very generously sharing it, but I do wonder whether we, those of us, you know, who can, should be paying for it. It's something to discuss perhaps another time, actually. There's a lot goes into it, and it's tremendous value, but again, the business, a bit like when we talk about journalism later, right at the time when it's never been more relevant, perhaps in recent years, it's under the worst financial stress. So, food for thought for another conversation, Alanta. Lovely talking to you, Alanta Colley. Science educator and comedian from Australia.